Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Okay, today I want to continue talking about purity. Last week we talked about wholesome and unwholesome qualities of mind. We focused particularly on unwholesome because that is what leads to our suffering. And we learned that the Buddha defined unwholesome very clearly in terms of five qualities that come together in our unwholesome actions. We talked a little bit about karma, and how karma is actually largely explained in psychological grounds on the basis of what is unwholesome. So today I want to begin talking about sensual passions and provide a little bit of analysis of that. Sensual passions. Let's take lust or sensual passion, raga, as another example of an unwholesome mental factor. Alongside anger, lust is another major fountainhead of human intentionality. Although we tend to think of lust in Western culture as a positive factor in our lives, unlike anger, in terms of the five factors that we talked about last week, we readily discover otherwise. Let's go through those five factors. One, lust is grounded in greed, that is, in neediness. Two, lust also tends toward harm. For instance, stealing is often a result of lust, including stealing someone's man or someone's woman. Often lust is even consciously self-destructive. People sacrifice physical health out of lust for food, drink, cigarettes, hang gliding, and so on, and sacrifice mental health out of lust for electronic entertainment, drugs, and so on. People are often propelled by lust from one unhealthy and unhappy sexual relation to another. Three, we lose wisdom under the spell of lust. I'll say, sometimes we sacrifice careers and marriages, as well as health, in the hopes that love will find a way. When the object of lust is not attained or lost, depression and even suicide or murder can result. Four, lust is always at least a bit painful. Sometimes it's so painful we can hardly stand it. It often flares off in a fever of longing. Relief is possible if the object of lust is realized, but otherwise lust may lead to bitter disappointment, itself a kind of aversion or hatred. And finally, five, lust diverts us from the path to awakening. It agitates the mind, obstructing stillness and other skillful factors. It easily spins out other unskillful thoughts such as anger, jealousy, and greed for various means needed for satisfying lust, such as those sporty clothes or that sexy sports car. It easily becomes ingrained as unskillful habit patterns, that is, as addictions. This is quite an indictment against lust, one that the Buddha makes repeatedly. Why, then, do most of us tend to think of lust as something positive? I think it's because we confuse lust with pleasure. Lust seeks pleasure, and pleasure tends to evoke lust for more of the same or for an escalation of pleasure. Together, they're commonly bound in an intimate cycle of mutual conditionality and are thereby mistakenly identified with one another. However, the two are quite distinct. Lust is painful. Pleasure is pleasurable. Addiction is when this cycle spins out of control. The failure to properly understand the cycle of lust and pleasure and to recognize which is which has miswritten many lives and even the history of nations. The Buddha warns us, There is no satisfying lust, even by a shower of gold pieces. He who knows that lusts have a short taste and cause pain, he is wise. Even in heavenly pleasures, he finds no satisfaction. The disciple who is fully awakened delights only in the destruction of all desires. Caught up in a cycle of pleasure and pain, we imagine we are having fun. Worth investigating is the question, how much of our fun is pleasure and how much of it is pain? The answer may surprise us. Renunciation. Our job at this point is to become fully aware in our own experience of the nature of lust, and particularly of the dangers it brings. This tends to go against the grain of commonplace and common sense attitudes about lust. Aren't the passions the spice of life? Isn't it better to have loved and lost rather than never to have loved at all? Isn't life drab and aimless without the quest for sensual pleasures? Are we to renounce all that? In fact, we're in good company in these considerations. The Buddha-to-be entertained similar considerations. Even as I myself, before my awakening, when I was still an unawakened bodhisatta, thought renunciation is good, seclusion is good. But my heart didn't leap up at renunciation, didn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. The thought occurred to me, what is the cause, what is the reason why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeking it as peace? Then the thought occurred to me, I haven't seen the drawback of sensual pleasures. I haven't pursued it. I haven't understood the reward of renunciation. I haven't familiarized myself with it. That's why my heart doesn't leap up at renunciation, doesn't grow confident, steadfast, or firm, seeing it as peace. We do well to follow his example. Notice that the point, at least at this stage, is not to squelch sensual passions, but to understand them and see how they get us into trouble. In fact, this is what is described in the next two steps in the gradual instruction that we've been tracing in this exposition of the Buddhist life. These steps are the drawbacks, degradation, and corruption of sensual passions, and the rewards of renunciation. When lust arises, this is an opportunity for investigation. When we act out of lust, this is another opportunity. The unfolding of consequences upon acting out of lust provides yet another opportunity. The re-arising of lust in association with this unfolding provides still another opportunity for investigating the drawbacks, degradation, and corruption of sensual passions. At the same time, we do well to contrast these qualities of sensual pleasures with those pleasures that arise rather independently of lust, including the sublime pleasure of generosity, practiced with purest intentions as described in past talks. The primary example referred to by the Buddha of supramundane pleasures are those that arise through meditation, samadhi or jhana, which we've discussed way back in past talks. In this way, we come to understand the rewards of renunciation. In fact, the passage I just cited about the unawakened bodhisatta goes on to contrast worldly lust-entangled pleasures with the supramundane pleasure found in the states of meditation, along with the need to set worldly pleasures aside, at least temporarily, in order to enter into a meditative state. In this way, we discover that the pleasure of those meditative states has a much more profound and pure quality than mere worldly pleasures. Giving up worldly pleasures for the supramundane pleasures is a good trade. Renunciation takes this understanding of drawbacks of sensual passions a step further by avoiding them. A primary way to practice this is through sense restraint, or guarding of the senses, whereby we avoid the sensual contact that gives rise to passion in the first place. On seeing form with the eye, do not grasp at any theme or details by which, if you were to dwell without restraint over the faculty of the eye, evil, unskillful qualities such as greed or distress might assail you. Practice for its restraint, guard the faculty of the eye, secure your restraint with regard to the faculty of the eye. This is a challenging practice, which can be implemented gradually by becoming progressively less self-indulgent. In this way, we live our lives less on the basis of sensual pleasure with its attending suffering, and more on the basis of supramundane pleasure without concomitant suffering. Another of the many functions of the monastic community is to embody this kind of practice. Monastics are, in principle, renunciates, and observably, on average, the most joyful members of a Buddhist community. Their presence in the community provides a reality check for the more profligate members of the community, supplementing the inner work of studying drawbacks and rewards as described here. With them in our midst, we begin to realize the futility of finding lasting happiness in sensual pleasures. In practice, renunciation can also occur quite naturally, almost without notice, without squelching anything. Through careful investigation of the drawbacks of passion, one experiences in one area of human affairs or another dispassion, which is much like losing interest in childhood toys in favor of more adult things as we grow older. We might think of the goal of Buddhist practice as that of growing up, of becoming adults in a more profound way than we might have imagined. A fully awakened being has no regard whatever for sensual passions, but enjoys the constant bliss of supramundane serenity. Such is the aim of renunciation. Further progress in purity, renunciation, and dispassion distinguish the Buddhist. We see in the Noble Eightfold Path that there are points at which we get stuck along the path, largely related to recalcitrant, delusional conceptualizations that need to be broken down through very refined practices. This is why the Buddha also gave us the Noble Eightfold Path and a very sophisticated understanding of human psychology. Walking the Buddhist path will be seen to extend the practice of purity, and awakening will perfect it. Abode of the Gods. Purity is generally associated with abandonment and renunciation of the unwholesome and the worldly, which thereby pulls in the wholesome and the unworldly to fill the vacuum. There are also practices that directly develop wholesome and supramundane qualities, which thereby push in what is wholesome and unworldly. The Brahma Viharas are virtues that we try to encourage in Buddhist practice. They are almost always known by their Pali name, which means abodes of the Brahma gods. The Brahma Viharas have ethical implications and can be developed as an aspect of purity at an early stage through reflection and simple visualizations. They are four in number: kindness, metta; compassion, karuna; gladness, mudita; impartiality, upekkha. Kindness is the root virtue here. We've already encountered it as the basis of generosity and the opposite of ill will or hatred. Kindness is found close to home in the affection we feel for family and friends. However, in Buddhism, we encourage a kind of kindness that extends far beyond our realm of self-interest in that it embraces also those toward whom we would otherwise feel indifferent, and then further toward those for whom we would otherwise feel animosity. Compassion and gladness are manifestations of kindness. Compassion in relation to those who suffer bad fortune, and gladness in relation to those who experience good fortune. Compassion is a primary motivator to relieve the suffering of others, for instance, by feeding the hungry and rescuing the vulnerable. Gladness is a poor translation of a word that has no equivalent in English. It's often translated as appreciative joy, which I find no clearer. The best way to describe it is that it is the opposite of envy or jealousy. For instance, if our neighbor puts in a new swimming pool, wins the lottery, or purchases a new BMW, many of us experience envy, a form of hatred. We fume, "That should be me." The exceptional among us are glad for our neighbor and enjoy her good fortune. That's gladness. Equanimity perfects the other Brahma Viharas, ensuring impartiality. This means that the other virtues cover everyone, like rain that falls on chums and scoundrels alike, but also that the emotive elements that often accompany the other three Brahma Viharas are absent, rendering us unattached to the outcomes of the actions they inspire, lest we become frustrated when our compassionate or kind actions fail to retrieve their intended results. With equanimity, we can engage in compassionate action without the burnout that the word compassion, suffering along, suggests. In fact, the Brahma Viharas become ornaments of the mind, sources of supramundane joy. The Brahma Viharas are often practiced through meditative visualization techniques, with special emphasis on developing kindness, metta. For instance, by imagining that we are extending kindness in all directions to an ever-widening circle of beings. The practice of purity. I hope none of this discussion evokes images of goose-stepping thought police in the minds of listeners. In fact, if you have entered into the practices of generosity and harmlessness, you have inevitably already stepped into the practice of purifying the mind. This is because you are forced to confront volitional impulses wherever they tend toward harm or away from benefit. Every time you override a contrary mental factor in order to adhere to a precept, you are deconditioning an existing unskillful habit pattern and thereby purifying the mind. Every time kindness or generosity inspires your good deeds, you're strengthening your tendency in that direction, thereby purifying the mind. Even mixed motives, such as responding to peer or authority pressure, or just a sense of obligation in the absence of kindness, have a way of eventually giving way to purer motives. For instance, recall the precept not to assault living beings. Maybe you don't initially understand why the life of an ugly twiddlebug matters one snippet. But a twiddlebug is a living being, and you want to be a good Buddhist, so you don't kill twiddlebugs. After a few months, you'll discover something that was not there before, a warm heart with regard to twiddlebugs. They will have become your little friends. And you will even find that this result generalizes to other ugly beings as well, and even to certain people that you had once put in the same category with twiddlebugs. Your mind has become purer. Try it. Put away the bug swatter and the twiddle-enhanced raid, and see if you don't soften right up. We've seen earlier that a number of precepts actually have little directly to do with refraining from evil, except insofar as they produce, through purification, the kind of mind that will want to avoid evil. A precept against idle chatter, for instance, is rather victimless, especially given that cases in which it spills in disparagement of others are covered by other precepts concerning speech. Nonetheless, if you refrain from idle chatter over many months, you'll discover a quieter mind, less prone to proliferation of spurious thoughts, and therefore less prone to delusion. You will have simply, through observing this precept, made the mind purer. The non-ethics-based precepts develop purity of mind in much the way as ethical precepts, but avert eventual rather than immediate harm for others. Early monastic or novice training involves close monitoring of conduct by a senior monk or nun with whom one lives in dependence for at least 5 years. This checks deviation from a large set of precepts, but also any tendency towards self-centered behaviors, and produces a sangha with a high degree of mindfulness, self-awareness, and deliberation, as well as general purity in mind. Just as precepts and other physical practices define habit patterns that over time purify the mind, existing habit patterns that characterize your lifestyle may inadvertently depurify the mind. You do well to avoid these. A rather complex precept commonly observed by laypeople every quarter moon and by monastics always is the following. I undertake the rule of training to refrain from dancing, singing, music, going to see entertainments, wearing garlands, smartening with perfumes, and beautifying with cosmetics. These are activities that would turn the mind toward lust and pride. Similarly, the modern pursuits of playing violent video games and watching violent television programs or listening to hateful speech on the radio will turn the mind toward recurring thoughts of anger and fear. Channel or web surfing will turn the mind toward restlessness and discontent. Entertainments that excite lust will tend similarly to depurify the mind, even while doing no outward harm. You do well to moderate such habitual activities. Today we are awash in the playing out of unskillful habit patterns encouraged by the ubiquity of electronic media, so that the process of sensual restraint is even more challenging, but even more appropriate than ever before. In summary, there are kinds of bodily or verbal actions that have few immediate consequences in terms of benefit or harm to the world, yet carry karmic fruits insofar as they condition the mind toward decreasing skillfulness. Merit-making asks of you that you constantly monitor your intentions. For the gregarious minglers and mixers among us, it may be the first introspective encounter with the inner subjective world, generally extolled in Asian cultures, while Western cultures praise the outwardly directed individual, quick of response and versatile of task. At the same time that you take note of your basic intentions, you should notice when discomfort, such as stress or anxiety, arise. This is suffering, as well as the moments of satisfaction and joy that come with benefiting others. How is this satisfaction and joy different from the pleasure of buying new clothes, say, or a new electronic gadget? You should observe when greed or neediness or lust arises, when hatred or aversion or fear arises. At what point do you feel satisfaction as you pursue sensual pleasures? You should observe when you fall into the cycle of lust and pleasure and ask how much suffering is there in that cycle, particularly the anxiety of anticipation relative to actual pleasure. when you might be experiencing pleasure, are you instead already lusting after the next potential pleasure? You should observe delusion in the excuses and rationalizations you probably fabricate, if you're like most people, to explain your actions. These are delusive acts of mental karma that have their own intentions behind them. Look at these. With the observation of your own suffering and pleasure, along with your intentional impulses, insight into the human condition will arise. Shifting topics, I highly recommend that you begin a regular meditation at this point if you don't already have one. Following the breath, or any of what in the Theravada traditions is known as samatha, tranquility or absorption meditation, is highly recommended. This can be a yoga meditation instead of a specifically Buddhist form of meditation. Buddhist meditation is an advanced topic, properly discussed in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path, that builds on many prerequisite practices. However, a general meditation practice will bring immediate benefits, including the following. One, meditation will take the edge off the hectic flash and dazzle and anxious ebb and flow of modern life and settle the mind in a way that comes more naturally in simpler societies. You will find it therapeutic. Two, with the serenity you achieve in meditation, you will find that the mind slows down, thoughts are fewer, even off the cushion, and the introspective world becomes more accessible. This is a boon for practicing purity of mind. Three, you'll probably begin to experience, as your practice deepens, the supramundane pleasure of the meditative states that we've discussed today, and even learn to enter them at will. This will give a better appreciation of the rewards of renunciation. And four, you will be in a better position to take up the Buddha's more specialized techniques that turn meditation into a refined tool for generating insight beyond the more general function of producing serenity. Resources for simple meditation as instruction abound, and its practice is generally very enjoyable and rewarding.